Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send $10 in war stamps, plus a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica World Atlas. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and uninhibited as ever, Information, Please runs along tonight with a company consisting of John Kieran of the New York Sun, Franklin P. Adams, Oscar Levant, and the celebrated novelist, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of the current bestseller, So Little Time, Mr. John P. Marquand. We're going to begin, gentlemen, with a question that comes to us from Miss Stowaway of Dedham, Massachusetts. And this is a musical question. We ought to get all on it. It's a three-part question. What event in the news is suggested by each of these musical selections? Mr. Cohen, let's have the first. I have two hands, two musicians, as a matter of fact. Mr. Kieran.
I should think that would be the political convention location.
Don't be cryptic. Tell us where and
Chicago.
What party. Pardon?
Chicago.
What was being played then?
Chicago.
Chicago. And what's going to happen in Chicago?
The Democratic and Republican National Conventions for the nominations of presidents in 1944 election will be held there.
Anybody has anything to add to that? When are they going to be held, Mr. Levant?
July, I believe.
The Democrats are in July, and I think Republicans are before that.
Yes, I think they're...
On kind of the reservations are tough there.
It is very hard. Yes. That's right. And now the second event, second musical selection.
I'm not sure. That's a chorale. Is that by Tchaikovsky?
It is indeed.
Romeo?
Quite right.
And Juliet. I want to throw in the other phone.
Very good. Romeo and Juliet. Yes, don't forget Juliet.
No.
And what does it suggest to you in the way of a current event?
Romeo and Juliet.
That isn't current.
No, I'm thinking out loud again.
Running.
Somebody's in love, evidently, in the world. I don't know who that could
That's
be.
That's not a current event. Happens all the time.
Wait a minute. Romeo and Juliet.
Where did Romeo and Juliet take place?
In what theater, you mean?
No, in what city?
Oh, you mean in Italy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, John ought to know that.
Mr. Kieran.
Verona.
Right. What does Verona mean to any of you gentlemen?
Is that the casino way? No.
The what?
What's mixing up with that card game? No.
Mr. Marquand, anything taking place recently in Verona? Mr. Adams? Mr. Kieran?
Somebody was shot there.
Who?
Ciano.
Yes, Count Ciano.
Ciano.
Count Ciano was executed there. One of the methods by which the fascists are trying to woo the approval of the democracies is by shooting Count Ciano. I don't think we can count that as quite right, gentlemen. Now, how about the third and last? I have two hands again. Now, what does that song mean to you, gentlemen? Mr. Kieran.
Any bonds today.
Right, and what is
the opening of the fourth war loan drive.
That's quite right.
Tomorrow, not tonight.
Well, I started it tonight in the Bronx, anyhow.
Is that your own borough, Mr. Kieran? Did you start things off with a bang there?
No, the Bronx people are a little slow, so we have to start on ahead.
You'll hear from Bronx in the morning. Well, that gives us two out of three and sends $57 in war bonds to Miss Stowaway and a set of the Titanic. Started off beautifully, gentlemen. Try this one now from Helen Matthews of Natick, Massachusetts.
Natick.
Is it Natick? I'm awfully sorry.
Definitely Natick,
I'm awfully
yes.
sorry, Mr. Marquand. Natick. Maybe we better bust up the whole show. Natick, Massachusetts. If you were present at a meeting of these people, what would be the most likely locale? Locale, Mr. Adams?
You can have that one.
All right. Suppose you saw, at one spot, Southey, Coleridge, and Wordsworth. Where would these people be? Southey, Coleridge, Wordsworth, Mr. Adams.
In the lakes.
Where? What lakes? In what country?
England.
In England, yes. The Lake Country of England, Mr. Kieran.
Well, it's over a little toward the west coast, up above... well, it's well above Liverpool.
Well above Liverpool, yes. And a good thing, too. Yes, those are the three most famous lake poets, as they were called, because they did so much of their work near the famous and very beautiful Lake Country of England. Now, suppose these three people met together at one time. Where would they be meeting? Lieutenants Grant and McClellan and Lieutenant Colonel Lee. Now, the rank, Mr. Marquand?
Appomattox Courthouse.
I'm going to read that again, Mr. Marquand. Lieutenants Grant and McClellan, Lieutenant Colonel Lee, and the rank is important. Now, where would they be meeting? Mr. Kieran?
At West Point Military Academy.
Now, would Lee have been a lieutenant colonel at that time?
He was an instructor up there, I believe.
I don't think Grant was a lieutenant at that time.
But he was a lieutenant when he was graduated.
Mr. Marquand, can you help us out?
They would have met in Mexico City in the Mexican campaign.
Yes, in the Mexican War. That's quite right, Mr. Marquand, 1846 to 48.
I'm glad I didn't open my mouth.
This isn't the first time that you're glad, Mr. LeVant. In Scott's army that captured Chapultepec, they would have met together. They were all members of that army. After the battle, Grant and McClellan were made captains, and Lee was made a full colonel. Now, how about these four gentlemen, or at least three of them are? Eisenhower, Montgomery, Vatutin, and Hitler. If they all met together, where would it be most likely to be? Mr. LeVant.
Well, the first three met... Vatutin never met these boys. They would eventually meet in Berlin, is what you want me to say.
I'd love to have you say it.
Well, if you want me to, I will.
Say Berlin.
Berlin.
Berlin, yes. Very good. And that's where the four are most apt to meet. Any objections?
On the contrary.
They can meet a little ahead of time. It wouldn't be so bad.
Wouldn't be so bad either. That gives us two out of three. And sends us on to this question from D.W. Thompson of Bronxville, New York. Each of these authors is indebted for a current book title to a classic author. Gene Fowler is indebted to Shakespeare for a recent book. Mr. Kieran.
Good Night, Sweet Prince.
That's right.
That's the biography of John Barrymore, and the quotation is from Horatio's words when Hamlet dies in Hamlet.
Yes, that's a swell title. Mr. LeVant?
Lionel Barrymore has that inscription on his crypt or his tomb, on John Barrymore's.
He himself had it engraved.
He selected that. That's why the title of the book.
I didn't know that. It's a beautiful title for a book. Very good one. How about Wilbur Cross is indebted to Mark Twain for the title of a recent book, Mr. Adams?
A Connecticut Yankee.
Yes, he got that from Mark Twain's The Connecticut. Or is it A Connecticut?
A Connecticut Yankee, that's, King Arthur's Court.
That's right. Who is Wilbur Cross? Let's have a little information
He's
about
him. He's a former governor of Connecticut.
Yes, anything else?
And was head of the graduate school at Yale, and also was editor of the Yale Review.
Yes, a very distinguished
He
career.
Was also on information, please.
That's true. That tops it, Mr. Levine. The English novelist Richard Llewellyn, Welsh novelist, as a matter of fact, owes a current book title to a classic author. Who is that? Richard Llewellyn owes it to Goethe. And what book title, Mr. Levin?
None But the Lonely Heart.
That's quite right. None But the Lonely Heart. Where did he get that title from?
Well, Tchaikovsky got it first. He wrote a beautiful song, which I'd like to sing. And, you just mentioned it.
No approval here.
Yeah.
And what is the poem from which he got it called? You know?
You just said Goethe.
Yes, but what is the poem? Can you give us a line or two?
I'm a musician. Tchaikovsky did it. I'm not a poet.
That's enough for you. Mr. Kieran?
I don't know it.
Well, it's Goethe's famous lyric, Nur wer die Sehnsucht kennt, weiß, was ich leider.
What's your language? I'm sorry.
The language is all right, Mr. Levan. It's just the people. It's from Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, I think, a novel, long novel by Goethe, a very beautiful and famous poem. Well, that gives us three out of three. How about this one from Ellis Smith of New York City? This is a very interesting question, gentlemen. I'll ask you to listen to it with great attention. I'm going to summarize a famous, or not necessarily famous, a sea mystery. Let us imagine that an American tramp steamer is found, abandoned, and stripped of its cargo. The captain's papers showed that he had carried shoes, textiles, shoe machinery, and salt and dried fish on his way out. And on his return, he had carried silk, powdered eggs, tungsten, and goat and kid hides. In the cabin is found a well-thumbed copy of Melville's book, Typee. Now unravel the mystery for us as follows. From where had the ship cleared from these clues? This is not easy. Mr. Kieran.
I'd say cleared out of some... Do I have to name the exact port?
What would you...
Boston.
Get? Well, that's very good. That is an exact port. Mr. Marquand, what would you have said on that?
Yes, I'd have said Boston or New York.
Why would you have said Boston, Mr. Marquand?
On account of the shoe machinery, the United Shoe Machinery Company is near Boston.
Yes, and many other shoe manufacturing concerns.
Textiles, too.
Quite right. And how about where had it picked up its return cargo, Mr. Marquand?
China, probably at Canton.
What makes you say that, Mr. Marquand?
Because of the tungsten, and I've forgotten the other items in the manifest now, but they're obviously from China.
That's exactly right. And now the third part of this mystery, where had the ship been abandoned? You remember I mentioned that it's been stripped of its cargo and abandoned of its crew. Abandoned by its crew. Now, there's a clue in the little story I told which might give you a...
The Melville book is the clue.
That's the clue, Mr. Levant. Mr. Marquand?
It must have been abandoned in the South Sea Islands near Tahiti.
What makes you say that? That's quite right.
Because Typee deals with the savage tribes in a valley in Tahiti.
Yes, and why should they have abandoned the ship because of that?
Women.
Women? Now, what makes you say that, or what, Mr. Levant?
Well, in the Captain Christian book...
Yeah?
There were...
You mean the regular lure of the South Seas? Well,
in those days, it wasn't bad, Mr. Fetterman.
I can hardly remember. Adams, do you remember? Well, why, in Typee, which is one of Melville's most famous novels, Mr. Marquand, Mr. Levant is perfectly right, but how does he get at that?
How does every man get at it?
Why, the hero in Typee got tired of being at sea and jumped ship, didn't he, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
I don't think he had any particular reason to do it, except for the story.
Well, didn't he acquire, a consort on one of these South Pacific islands?
Well, I don't remember he did in Typee.
Marquand, but Levant remembers different. Yes, I think there was a very touching love affair in Typee, and one of the reasons that the sailors, as Mr. Levant reminds us, might have abandoned ship is because of the lure.
They did it before in that other book. What's the name of that book?
Mutiny on the
Bounty.
Yes.
Well, of course, they had Clark Gable. That was different.
Clark Gable. That's the clue. That gives us 3 out of 3 and passes us on to this one from Mrs. Jean Sand of New York City. Give the titles of 3 pieces of music, classical or popular, which include a word that might describe your wife's disposition. This seems a little personal. For example, To a Wild Rose, with wild as an example. Now, Mr. Kieran, will you help us out?
Lead kindly, light kindly.
Very sweet. Very, very sweet. The word is lead, I suppose, Mr. Kieran, that you're referring to. Mr. Levant?
Well, I could do a title with my wife's name in it.
Well, that's even cleverer. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of them. Her name is June. It's June night, June in January, June, moon, anything. Moon.
That's enough advertisement. Now, that, however, is not quite the answer. You must just give us a title that describes the disposition of
the disposition.
The disposition.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
That's very nice.
Sweet Rosie O'Grady.
Yes. The amount of intimidation by wives in this program is simply astonishing. Mr. Adams?
How green was my valley?
I hope that Mrs. Adams is not a confirmed radio listener, Mr. Adams. Mr. Levant?
How about paper doll?
Paper doll?
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
Not so good. How about Pacific 231 by Onager?
Onager. That's a steam engine locomotive.
Yes, or...
I don't see the connection.
You don't? Well, Pacific might be the disposition of your wife.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Get it? Just beginning to dawn on you, Mr. Adams.
Honey that I love so well.
Thank you. You've retrieved yourself, Mr. Adams. I was waiting for that. Our next question is aimed directly at our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. Quite a number of people want to know, Ben, why they sometimes have difficulty getting Heinz baby foods.
Well, Kip, last year there were more babies than ever before. A grand total of more than 3 million. H.J. Heinz Company put up more baby food, too. Then, too, mothers are busier than they've ever been now, with war duties as well as home duties. Getting anyone to help around the home is a problem, all right. Fresh vegetables and fruit sometimes are none too plentiful and often high-priced. So, naturally, more and more mothers turn to scientifically prepared baby foods to save time and money and to make sure that baby gets all the nourishment, vitamins, and minerals he needs. An amazingly large number of them ask for Heinz baby foods because they have a well-founded faith in Heinz's reputation for quality. And these same mothers are really impressed when they taste Heinz baby foods. They notice their fine, tempting flavor, the full natural color and the smooth, even texture. There's the most convincing proof that Heinz baby foods, like all the other 57 varieties, are good and really good to eat.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now shall we continue with this question from Charles Mager of New York City. Get 2 out of 3. Mr. Marquand, you are, I understand, a Harvard man?
I used to be.
Oh, once a Harvard man, always a Harvard man, Mr. Marquand. Now, this is a question about other famous Harvard men. Can you name the Harvard man if I tell you where he was born and where his career reached its high-water mark? Now, in the first case, the Harvard graduate was born in Brooklyn and, of course, Rose, and his career reached its high-water mark in Park Row. Who was that?
Where's Park Row?
Park Row is downtown. You've never been below 34th Street?
I've never been downtown.
No, it's wonderful down there, Mr. Levant. What they need is a Lindy's around Wall Street to get Mr. Levant down there. Mr. Marquand?
Could it be Horace Greeley? Except he didn't go to Harvard. That's the only trouble.
That's the only trouble. That is, and I don't think he was born in Brooklyn either.
No, I don't think he was either.
Well, I don't think the Tribune was in Park Row at that time. But it's a brilliant guess, Mr. Marquand. Now, Mr. Levant.
It's either Haywood Broun or Walter Lippmann. I don't know where.
Choose one.
Where was Haywood Broun born?
Brooklyn.
All right, Haywood Broun.
Good, yes. That's right. Haywood Broun was born in Brooklyn. He attended Harvard, and he worked for the old world during his most brilliant days on Park Row. Now, how about a Harvard man who was born in Portland, Oregon, and his career reached its crisis in Moscow?
I know that one.
You know that one.
Yeah.
I'd like to get it out of this Harvard man here, Mr. Marquand.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
John Reed.
That's right. Who was John Reed? Give us a little dope on him.
Well, John Reed was in Harvard about 1910 or 1911.
I think it was 10. Wasn't that the famous class of 1910 that had so many brilliant men?
Well, I don't know who else was in it.
John Reed and Waldo
Pierce, the artist.
There were a number of others, yes. And how did he happen to get to Moscow?
Well, now that I don't remember. He went over as a newspaper man, didn't he?
Yes, as a correspondent, Mr. Levant.
I could fill in. He did some stories on Mexico long before the Russian, and his big fame came on a strike in New Jersey where he was arrested.
Patterson, was it?
Yes, Patterson strike. Then he went to Mexico for a magazine called the Metropolitan Magazine. A friend of mine was the editor, Carl Hovey. I hope he's listening in.
He interviewed Villa personally,
didn't he?
Oh, you see, you do know now.
And then he met a woman whose name I won't mention, but she mentions all the time in a book called Mabel Dodge Luhan. I've forgotten the name of the book. I know her name. And then he went to Russia.
Talk about filling in.
And he died. He died and wrote a book called 10 Days That Shook the World.
Yes, that is a very good, reasonably complete, though somewhat staccato story of Mr. John Reed's life, yes. He, as a matter of fact, is buried today in the Kremlin. Yes.
There's a good book about him by Granville Hicks, about 5 cents.
That's
8 years
right.
ago. Yeah.
A very good book.
In college, just as a prank, he was going over on a cattle steamer, and when they were 5 miles off Boston, he jumped overboard and swam ashore, and his friend Waldo Pierce was arrested for murder when he arrived in Liverpool.
That's fun. That must have I never knew a man, Mr. Marquand, so anxious to get back to Harvard that he swam 5 miles to do it. Really hard to understand. How about a Harvard man who was born in Boston and his career reached its high water mark in Tokyo? That's perhaps not quite so easy, Mr. Marquand.
Mr. Grew.
Yes, that's right. Our ambassador to Japan from 1932 to the outbreak of the war. His first two names?
Joseph E.
I think it's Joseph Clark, isn't it? Joseph C. Grew? Joseph Clark Grew. That gives us 2 out of 3. Now, how about this one, gentlemen, from Beatrice Seligman of New York City. In what wars might you have found the following characters of literature soldiering together? Here are 3 names. Tjaden, that's T-J-A-D-E-N, Müller, or Muller, and Krupp, K-R-O-P-P. These are characters in what was at one time a very famous book, a very great bestseller. Mr. Levant?
No, I was in Three Soldiers. It's not Three Soldiers. No,
Mr. Marquand?
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Very good, Mr. Marquand. That's quite right. Remarks, famous bestseller of the First World War, All Quiet on the Western Front. Good memory, Mr. Marquand. How about this set of soldiers? Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan. That's perhaps a little, Mr. Marquand again?
3 Musketeers.
Well, what war, though?
Oh, that.
They were after a necklace.
Have to ask Mr. Kieran on that.
They were after a necklace, not a war.
Well, there is a war in which they were engaged.
Yes,
Mr. Kieran?
There was a war in... they were engaged in... civil war right inside France.
The siege of Rochelle.
Yes, during the War of the Fronde, I think it was called.
Well, it was a civil war, but the siege of La Rochelle was a foreign war.
Well, now, who is right, then, Mr. Marquand?
He's right, too. We're both right.
Can't both be right.
Well, as a matter of fact, they fought on opposite sides in the War of the Fronde.
Yes.
D'Artagnan and Porthos were on one side, and Aramis and Athos were on the other side.
That's right.
La Rochelle, they were all united.
Will you accept that,
French,
Mr. Marquand?
Fighting the Spaniards in that section, the representatives of the Spanish army.
That seems full enough, unless you want to fill in, Oscar.
There was always a king named Philip around that time, I know that.
Yeah,
somebody had a king named
Philip. He isn't
Philip.
In this question. I'll see if I can get him in another question. How about this collection of characters, and what war might you have found them together? Maurice Schur, Jack Mulligan, and Cooker Shoemate. Mr. Adams.
I think that was in Three Soldiers.
Then I'll take it.
Take it,
Mr. Sun also?
Oh, no, that's wrong, too.
No, I don't mean this. The one by Hemingway, the first book.
No.
What was the name of that book?
Sun Also Rises.
The Sun that's Also right, Rises. Yeah. Mr. Adams, another thought? It's in the present or current war, World War II, and it's in a famous bestseller known as See Here, Private Hargrove.
I never read it.
I guess we didn't do so very well on that. Well, I guess we got 2 out of 3 on that, come to think of it. Now, you were late on All Quiet on the Western Front.
No, I was muttering. I didn't answer anything.
I was
going to say Mr. Muller's name is in Watch on the Rhine, which is quite legitimate.
Was that just a mutter?
That was a mutter.
All right.
The boy's best friend.
It's certainly Mr. Marquand's best friend. How about this one from Franklin S. Pollock of Johannesburg, South Africa? All the way from South Africa, ladies and gentlemen. Can you tell what part of the hour it is from the tolling of the characteristic phrase of the Westminster chimes that we're now going to listen to? We're going to listen to 3 parts of the hour. We have to get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first. Now, in London, when you hear that, what time is it? Or what part of the hour, Mr. Levant?
Quarter after.
Quarter after?
Yeah.
No, it's a quarter of. In the first case. That was the third quarter. 1 quarter would be 15 minutes before some hour.
I'm a half hour off.
You're a half hour. Yes. Now, how about the second characteristic chime? Now, what part of the hour would that be if you heard that in London or in the vicinity of London? It gets easier as it goes along, Mr. Adams.
I think that's the half hour.
That's the quarter hour.
Yes. Why don't you guess right, Mr. Adams? Yes,
you're guessing.
Right, you're right there. It's a quarter past any particular hour. And now the third characteristic, tolling. Now, we have practically no chance to get this wrong. Mr. Marquand?
Well, that must be the half hour.
Well, that's wrong. It's on the hour. Well, in all my experience, I have never seen a question muffed more clearly and lucidly than that one was. That sends only $57 to Mr. Pollock and a set of the Britannica. He really should get double on that one. How about...
You know, you can't hear the chimes here from Westminster, though. It's awful hard.
Try this one. Gertrude A. Bacorn of Ann Arbor sends this in. Recite three lines that mention musical terms used in the writing of music. Any technical or semi-technical terms? Give us some lines of poetry or famous lines of prose.
Oh.
Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant?
White Clefs of Dover.
Gee, that's a far reach. I'll take it. Very good.
It's not good.
Oh, I don't know. Don't run yourself down. Others can do it for you, Mr. Levant. Mr. Kieran?
Stone walls do not a prison make, or iron bars a cage.
The bars, yes. Bars, very good. Yeah. Now we have clef, and we have bars. Now, no, it should be very easy, Mr. Levant.
Something of House Dale, flat, unprofitable, and like a bankruptcy, that poem, that one.
That's a very good one. Will you straighten out, Mr. Levant, on the quotation?
Weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable are all the uses of the
word. Seemed to me all the uses of this world. That's a very good. The
Give me one with rest. Rest and sharp would be the other two.
Go ahead. Let's have one.
Let John. I'll give him the cue.
Mr. Kieran?
There is rest for the weary. There is rest for you.
There's one.
Rest is silence.
Yes, either of those two. Thank you.
What about sharp?
What one?
Unsharp, yeah.
His nose was sharp as a pen, and a babbled a green field.
There's another one, see?
Yeah. Well, it gives us at least three. Now we have here a musical quotation which may prove an inspiration to our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. Do you recognize it?
Well, that's mighty like a rose. And it does remind me of something which to most people would seem mighty unlike any rose. I'm referring to vitamin C. Yes, sir, it seems that roses, or rather the fruit of the rose, known as rose hips, have been found to be rich in vitamin C. So are green walnut shells, pine needles, and several of our common weeds. I read all that in a little magazine published under the auspices of the research department of H.J. Heinz Company. Of course, we're not suggesting that you go for a handful of pine needles or rose hips. Oh, no. The Heinz Company has always believed that the best way for normal people to get their vitamins and minerals is in food. And that all food should taste delicious. Now, take baby food, for instance. The Heinz Company urges mothers to taste their baby's strained and junior food. When they do, they discover that Heinz baby food does have a fine, fresh flavor, a rich, natural color and smooth texture. For Heinz cooks go to a lot of trouble to preserve the fresh flavor and color as well as the vitamins. And whether it's food for baby or soup, baked beans or pickles, there's one thing you know about all Heinz 57 varieties. They're the very best that science, nature, and the art of good cooking can produce.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now a question from Charles M. Bogert of New York City. What persons might be found in the following places, more or less? First in a hong, H-O-N-G. Second in a tong, T-O-N-G. And third in a sarong. Who'd be found in a hong? We've got to get hong first. What person might be found in a hong? Of course, you have to know what a hong is.
Is that the first part of Kong?
It's an establishment or factory for foreign trade in China, and you'd find Chinese merchants in a hong. Well, that gives us one wrong. Now, how about tong?
I know that.
You know tong? Yeah. I have three hands on that. Mr. Adams, let's...
It's a Chinese society.
Yes, it's a Chinese secret society. And in a sarong, you would find, Mr. Levant?
Dorothy L'Amour any night. In every country.
You seem to have the goods on her.
No, I don't.
That gives us... Two out of three, but we were required to get all on that, sending $57 to Mr. Bogart and a set of the Britannica, and that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Marquand, for helping out with the fun this evening. Tonight, H.J. Heinz Company has paid out $114, $171, I beg your pardon, in war bonds and stamps, and three sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, along with our veteran pair, John Kieran and Franklin P. Adams, we will have as our guests Elizabeth Janeway, author of the best-selling novel The Walsh Girls, and our good friend, the music critic and distinguished radio personality, Mr. Deems Taylor. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to information, please, at 5... 5-